Today, on this episode of On the Line, we are catching up with one of Amanda's oldest friends, somebody that she's known, cooked with for 22 years.
Yes, I've known Missy Robbins, everybody, for over 22 years. We're going to dig into the past a little bit. But we all know Missy and love Missy, and I can't wait to talk to her.
You've tasted her food, and now you can hear her beautiful voice.
Welcome, Missy Robbins.
Thank you.
To okay, On the Line. This is our podcast hosted by me, Amanda Freitag, and Daniel Holtzman.
Yeah. That's awesome and best part of my day so far.
I can't thank you enough for being here, for real.
I mean, like, I get to sit in a room with the two of you.
We get to be here with you.
Like, we've known each other for what, 20?
22 years.
All of us. For 22 years?
Yes. We've known each other for sure, wow. 22 years. Yes. I feel like
12,
I've known you.
12 to 17.
I'm going to go with 20. Let's just say 20.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I got to write your bio. I got to read your bio. I'm so sorry. There.
But just also so the guest and the listeners know that this is written by Dan himself.
Wonderful. His term
That's
paper.
That's a disclaimer. That was not a
No, okay. That's an accolade.
I appreciate that. Our next guest on the line. You could tell it was written by me.
That's what my mom says. On
the line. Our next guest on the line has earned her place as one of the truly outstanding chef restaurateurs of our generation. Woo-hoo. Before she became the chef owner that we know today, Missy paid her dues as a cook on the line. Her education is as storied and replete with blood, sweat, and tears as anyone out there. She worked in kitchens big and small and rustic and fancy and up and down the East Coast and across the Atlantic and back again. She has a degree in art history from Georgetown University alongside her degree from Peter Kump's Cooking School here in Manhattan. But as a chef, Missy's career is truly remarkable. She left Chicago cooking at Spiaggio and feeding the Obamas. Sorry.
No big deal.
Back to the Big Apple as chef of Avoce. Avoce was a spectacular restaurant, and there have been plenty of great Italian restaurants, but Avoce was a behemoth and one of the first restaurants where Italian food was truly recognized by the press. It's hard to imagine today, but more recently than we'd like to remember, French food was the only cuisine awarded accolades. Italian food was simply not taken seriously, but under Missy's leadership, this is a real situation. You agree. Avoce broke through, and it wasn't a small restaurant. It was an extraordinary. It was an absolute beast, and there were two of them, and I can like feel the pressure and the extraordinary education and tremendous accomplishment running these two restaurants was. That's like it was a extraordinary, right? Like
I mean, we'll get into okay. it.
I remember and, that time,
and I feel like it almost killed you. Actually.
literally,
yes.
But fancy Italian food was not Missy's ultimate calling. She retreated. For a year and a half and like a butterfly. I mean, that's not really. She emerged in Brooklyn with Lilia, a very, very special restaurant that was immediately recognized by everybody who stepped through the doors. There's been enough said about Lilia, but suffice to say that pandemic later, the place is still challenging to get a reservation. and worth the wait. And you should go to Missy and eat her spectacular pasta because... Missy Robbins' food is spectacular, and we are extremely excited to talk to her today. And I want to thank you so much for the memorable meals, and your restaurants are brimming with hospitality, and eating there is like snuggling into a warm bowl of macarinara.
Marco Canora?
Macarinara. also, macarinara is my favorite pasta.
But I also
China.
Love Marco Canora.
Yes, it's like snuggling up with
yeah,
Marco
Canora.
Yeah,
well, he's Canora. Got the burrito and your cookbooks. The cookbooks are I've cooked from the cookbooks.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for buying
Missy Robbins, everybody.
Missy Robbins.
Is that the end of your intro?
No, there's another couple pages,
more?
But I'll leave it at that.
Let's stop right there.
No, I talk about the future.
Well, let's just say that
it's true, though. It all is true. I mean, Avoce, Jesus Christ.
Let's start with Avoce because
Sorry.
That is a big deal.
Yeah, Avoce
restaurant for our listeners who didn't know was in
Madison
Square Park.
Square Park,
and then in Columbus Circle.
Yes, and I had some really big shoes to fill, Andrew Carmelini.
Oh my God.
Was the original chef of a voce.
Do you know that I didn't even remember that?
Isn't that all you to me? He was there for a year.
He was only there for a year, but at the time, I mean, I will say he was like kind of the hottest chef in New York.
It's true.
A voce was getting so much press and he was leaving and I needed to leave Chicago. I had a wonderful 5 years there.
It was amazing.
And I love Tony Montuano is still one of my best friends and my greatest mentor. But Chicago was not home for me.
Because of the freezing cold or the hot dogs?
No, I just think like, all right. So you moved to LA from New York, right? And I think when I moved to Chicago, I was 32. Mm. I was single. I moved for the job specifically. I wasn't like dying to move to Chicago, but I think like I thought that Chicago was just gonna be like a little New York.
Yeah.
And it's a very different city. Mm. My mom grew up in Chicago. My brother has lived in Chicago
like
for like
angry white people or something, or
it's just little. It's a small city. It's a small city and it's just like different and
it feels
very
Midwestern. Is there something about that?
I don't want to insult it.
No, but like it's very different than the East Coast.
I think it's a hard city also. For me, it was a little hard because I was working every night. Yeah. And so I still work nights then. And I think it's a hard city to make new friends. It's very clicky. People are still friends with their elementary school friends. I wasn't like really available.
Yeah.
But like my brother and sister-in-law have lived there for 20-something years. We lived a 10-minute walk away. My niece and nephew were born while I was there.
Oh, wow.
So like
there were
reasons to stay. And I had and Spiaggia was an incredible, incredible place. But I wanted to go back to New York. And I was like, I was kind of annoyed one day. And I had this office at Spiaggia, like it was a closet. But I was the only person who had my own office. So I went in the door. I was like annoyed with Tony. I was annoyed with life. I was annoyed with Chicago. And I was on the phone with a friend of mine, Todd Stein, chef in Chicago, and he said, you know, I just read on like Eater or something that Andrew Carmelini's leaving a voce. You should really apply for that job.
Wow.
And
I was like,
you applied for that job?
This is a great story. This is a great story. And I was like, there is no way that I'm getting that job. Like I'm like known in Chicago. I'm a little bit known in New York, but not really. Like,
were you the chef of Spiaggia?
I was the executive chef, but Tony was the chef owner.
Got it.
Like, Avoce was really the first place that I was the chef without
I'm so sorry.
No, please.
Tony was the chef. How long had you been the chef of, like, the executive chef of Spiaggia?
Most of the time you were
there.
The whole
time. 5 years.
Yeah.
Four or 5 years. Got it.
The whole time.
So you had experience.
I was hired as the chef de cuisine.
Got it.
And for semantic reasons and for some things that like occurred in the larger company, it's owned by Levy Restaurants, they changed my title so that I would have certain privileges, which was like a great move on their part. But essentially I was like still kind of a chef de cuisine. Like Tony wasn't in the kitchen, but it was like his food.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was my food through his lens deal. And I loved it, but I really like kind of wanted to prove that I could be a chef on my own. And that was part of the impetus for leaving outside of the New York stuff. So I was like, I'm not going to get that job. So I had a former publicist. I don't know if I've ever told this story publicly. I had a former publicist who I was like, she was like my best friend in Chicago. And I called her and I said, there's this job. Like, do you think that you could pretend to be my agent and send them a letter?
I love it.
She's like, yeah, sure. So she sends this letter saying, I represent Missy Robbins. She's the only 4-star Italian chef, and blah, blah, blah. She's going on and on. And I remember I had like just finished a workout and I was like, for some reason at my trainer's house, I don't know why. and they called me. And they were like, yes, the like director of whatever, the company. They were part of a larger company. They were from London.
Yes.
Did he have an accent or something?
No, he was American, but he worked there. And I said, oh, I can't talk to you right now, but I'd love to talk to you. And this was like literally like 10 minutes after she sent the letter. And they're like, we're going to be in New York next week. Do you think we could come do a tasting at Spiaggia?
I'm like,
how am I going to explain this to Tony?
Yeah.
So I went to Tony and I said, and Tony and I had like gone back and forth on like, trying to open a restaurant in New York. And it was like becoming more and more obvious that it just was like sort of not it wasn't like the right time yet for me to do that.
Right.
And so I went to Tony and I said, there's this job in New York and they want to come do a tasting. And like, I know it's awkward. You know, he knew that I wanted to leave.
Right.
And I was like, do you think it's okay? And he's like, yeah, sure. And I think he was like a little bit bummed, hurt. But he was like, it wasn't like out of nowhere that this discussion happened. So they came and it was like very cute. Tony kind of like hung out.
Oh.
And he like checked them out.
Of course, like a dad. Father.
Yeah,
would.
Like yes. Yeah. And he leaves like a few minutes after, and he let me do my thing. And the next day, I had a meeting with them at the Peninsula in Chicago. I mean, this is not my speed.
This is your set.
This is not what I do.
When you're not.
So I go to the.
Well, you have an agent.
I have a fake agent at this point.
Fake agent.
And then I go to the Peninsula. And basically, they offer me a job on the spot.
Whoa. Wow.
And they throw out this outrageous salary.
Wow.
And I'm like, okay. I'm like fascinated
like,
by the job.
ATM.
You have to understand at the time.
Yeah. What year was this now?
This was 2012? I started there in 2013. No, sorry. So, no. Sorry. 2008.
2008. Right.
And so I go back to Spiaggia, and I was like, he's like, how'd it go? And I'm like, well, they offered me this pretty great job. And you know what he said? I mean, this is what a mensch Tony Montuano is.
We love him.
He said, yeah, you should do that.
Wow.
I love him.
I know. It's amazing. And it's been very impactful in like, as I've had people want to leave and go do things and whatever. Like,
you know how to trick them into staying.
I do know that. But I also, like, that was pretty kind.
Yeah.
And I've, like I said, I've stayed best friends with him.
But that's a true mentor.
He's an incredible mentor. And so, but I told the Aboche guys, I said, listen, I've invested 5 years into Spiaggia, and I'm not, and it's like my home, and I'm not going to leave until they're set up.
Right.
And so I gave 4 months notice.
Woo! Wow. Did everybody hear that? 4 months notice.
I would recommend. I would not recommend it.
A month a year.
But I set them up. They ended up promoting Sarah Gruenberg, who's gone on do like amazing things. Sarah started on Garmanger with me.
Wow.
And she ended up being the chef. So that's like a pretty cool success story. And I left and I came to Spiaggia. And
well, so before you went to Spiaggia, what New York restaurant had you been at?
Well, Amanda.
No, because I don't.
I started my career at Arcadia.
Right. We actually, Jonathan Waxman was a guest and he was talking about Anne Rosenzweig and just explaining her in perfection, you know, how focused and committed she was, how I said stern, he said firm.
There were different adjectives.
I mean, she was like...
because it was Anne Rosenzweig or Diane Forley at that time, so...
Anne was definitely the hardest on me that anyone's ever been, but she was also extremely nurturing.
Right.
So it would be like... You know, I was also a punk. I was 24 years old. I was going out every night. I was having a very good time.
Would anybody ever think of Missy as a punk?
No.
Never.
Or would anyone ever think Missy goes out every night? Like, all I want to do is go to sleep at 10 o'clock, maybe 9 these days. And I worked the morning shift. So not only was I going out every night, but I also worked the morning shift.
Ooh.
And
you didn't go to sleep? Yeah, that happened.
Never go to sleep, but... I definitely had some moments, not at Arcadia. So I worked at Arcadia. I definitely went in when I maybe shouldn't have been working.
Yeah.
And I like remember this is one particular day where
still
like I just
buzzy.
Couldn't. I was like just, you know.
From the alcohol?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And I was like working. It was my first hotline job. And I was like just sweating.
No.
It was like the summer. And like I was dying. And Anne... So I said to the sous chef's name at the time was Linda, and I said every day I would say, whether I'd been out or not, I would say, hey, Linda, is Ann coming in today?
Because you knew what kind of a day it was going to be.
And every day Linda would say, yes, Missy, it's her restaurant. She's coming in. And every day she would come in and like right before service and you'd be so in the weeds getting set up. Woo. And I had like no idea what I was doing. And one day she like kind of like, you know, she's small woman. And
yes.
She like came up to me and she's like, why aren't you set up? And I was like, and I am very hungover.
Oh my God.
And I'm trying my best.
You're doing your best.
Wow.
And like she would contagious. Get so mad, but then at I the same it. Time she would like turn around and like kind of think you're funny.
Right.
And because I was like truthful, she like kind of couldn't get mad at me.
She couldn't.
So like she was tough on me. So I left Arcadia after about almost 2 years. And I had done my internship when I was in cooking school at March with Wayne Nish.
Oh, that's right.
And
Wayne.
I really loved it there.
That's
and I
such
really
a
wanted
beautiful.
To. Oh, it was the best. And I really wanted to work there. And there were no positions, like full time positions, when I was done with my externship. So I went. I went to Arcadia, and then like Wayne called me and was like, "Hey, I finally have a spot," and it was like a no-brainer for me.
Yes.
And so I went to Anne, and I remember giving her my notice.
Ooh, were you scared?
And now it's
I
just like
a little scared.
Well, no,
that.
Now it's just like so funny because now when people are like, "Hey, chef, I need to speak to you," I was like, "Where are you going?" and the same thing.
Yes. Can I talk to you after service?
Yeah. Can I talk to you? Or they'll send you an email. My favorite is when you guys get this. They send you an email on their day off, the day before they come back. And they're like, can I have a meeting? And I'm like, oh, I wonder where they stashed yesterday.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. So I remember sitting outside. Arcadia had like four lovely tables outside. You remember that?
Yes.
And I said, Anna, I'd like to talk to you. And I'm like terrified. And she pulls me outside and she sits down and she said, where are you going?
She
and
was
I,
no
said,
fool.
I said, I'm going to go back to March. Like, it's been so great here, whatever. And she gave her blessing and it was fine. But I just like remember you. Chefs always know.
They always know.
For you cooks listening, we always know when you're giving your notice.
Right.
It's not
so don't think you're being sneaky.
Not a surprise. And then I went to March. I worked there for, again, almost 2 years. And
March, just for anybody who doesn't know, was just this
gem.
Gorgeous gem of a restaurant. It was in Brownstone, wasn't it?
In a brownstone.
Beautiful brownstone. Wayne Nish was just this, I mean... He was just like an artist.
He was an artist. He taught me.
Is he still around?
He's around. He's around. He does a lot of consulting stuff. I haven't talked to him in a while, but.
But that was kind of every chef's dream to work there.
I'll say this. Like, I think he was way ahead of his time.
Yes, absolutely.
I think he was using ingredients that no one was using. I think he was like.
Are there ingredients that you took with you from there and still find yourself using, or you were like...
No, but when I think about March, not necessarily ingredients, he used a lot of Asian stuff, which I at one point thought I was going to kind of go in that direction because it was so fascinating. He was a quarter Asian, Japanese.
Yeah. Yes.
And so he had that influence in his life. And what I really took away from him was just kind of the quality of ingredients. And I remember he used to get like incredible olive oils and cheeses, and like the ingredients were just awesome. And like, I think about like a lot of his technique and stuff like that. Like
sauces.
I say about him that I kind of learned fine dining there. So, like, Arcadia was fine dining, but, like, this was, like, real fine dining.
It was really finessed.
Really finessed. And also, you know, I think he was one of the sort of pioneers of, like, choose-your-own-adventure tasting menus. So when I worked there, not when I was an intern, but when I went back, he had changed the model. And he had this menu that was four quadrants, and it would be like sea, land, blah, blah,
yes.
blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my gosh.
And you could have a six top,
and
you
they
could
would have
six,
28 different
six different tasting menus.
Stop.
But it was like, yeah, I would have like a fryer going, and a fryer meaning a copper pan with clarified butter in it. That's how he fried. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
Yum.
And I would have like six pans of foie gras going, and like... It was a really hard kitchen. You weren't doing crazy covers, but you were doing a lot of stuff, and just the
dance,
the bar the was timing. Really was, and it wasn't a lot of cooks. It was like five or six hired cooks on the line, and then like 20 externs in the kitchen.
I feel like we all have at some point in our lives made the mistake of just making it way too hard for ourselves, and then we're committed, and you're like, all right, now I built this behemoth and I got to do it.
But I loved it though. Yes. I loved it. I was young. I was 25, 26 when I started with him, and I loved it, but again, I was still a little bit of a punk.
But you were sleeping most nights at this point.
I lived across the street.
Oh, dream.
I lived across the street. So I would like, and that is when I sort of gave up the shift drink. So there was a period where like you were kind of allowed to like have some beers and whatever cocktail you want. And like we would hang out in the garden. And I was like, I live across the street. Like, what am I doing? and I mean, literally across the street.
You're unwinding.
And so I kind of like was like, yeah, I don't need to do this. Like, I really don't need to do this. And it kind of shifted my perspective on that part of
work life balance. On the shift.
For me, that like every night at the end of your shift, they would come back and say, what do you want? What's your order?
Totally.
And one guy ordered an orange juice and everybody made fun of him.
Remember that guy. I had that guy in my kitchen too.
Nowadays, can you imagine making fun of someone for not like, you know, for declining
my restaurant.
There's no shift drink.
My restaurant's no shift drink.
Yeah.
And you're not the only one.
Drink. I mean, my restaurant, you're not allowed to drink in my restaurant if you work
there. Liability.
The only time you can have a cocktail is if you come in with your family.
Yeah,
and you're not working and whatever, but we had no drinks.
Way.
Yeah, that's a thing
different
in the past.
World. Very, very much a thing
we're
in the past.
We're a big fan of no longer promoting alcoholism. I think that's reasonable. That's
and
okay.
I think it's a good thing. But March was like my place, but I was a little bit of a punk still. Sous chef left. I thought I deserved the sous chef position.
And mm-hmm. Probably rightfully so.
Not rightfully so. And I didn't get it.
Ooh,
and
that's crushing.
It's a good story. It's a very good story. He brought in a gentleman named Mike Anthony.
Oh, Mike Anthony,
everybody.
Never going to work for that guy. I'm out of here.
The chef of Gramercy Tavern right now. Amazing man.
I stayed for 6 months, but kind of always with a chip on my shoulder.
I've been there.
And Mike and I had very different styles, let's say.
Yes.
We'd come from very different kinds of kitchens. In hindsight, 25 years later, Mike deserved the job. He had worked in Japan and France Danielle and da-da-da-da. And
I didn't know it was Mike Anthony.
Yeah, it's a great story. And now Mike and I are like totally friends and like really respect each other.
We have such a same sensibility.
We do have a similar sensibility, but cook really differently.
Yes.
Mike is like one of the most respected.
He's the best. Mike's the best. And I have to tell you, I have never, ever heard one not good thing about Mike Anthony.
He's also the nicest.
Not a bad word about Mike Anthony. I saw him the other day. He's just such a
nicest human.
I feel like Mike and I like grew up together.
Yes.
On the same exact note, I'm sorry to interject here, but Nate Appleman and I were working at the Campton Place.
Wow.
And this guy, the chef was leaving, and this guy comes in from Switzerland, and he does his tasting.
I know who it was.
And he put these diamond peppers around the plate.
Do you know who
diamonds
it is?
Of peppers
no.
on the plate. And Nate and I looked
at
each other, and we were like, there is no chance we're working for this pretentious. We were out of there. Both of us quit that day.
Diamond peppers.
Daniel Hum.
Stop.
Yeah.
It was his first job.
It was his first job in America.
Oops.
Yeah, both of us were like, see you later, buddy.
Oh, my God, that's so amazing. Yeah. So amazing.
What can we learn from this fool?
What?
Turns out, yeah, oops.
Oopsie.
Yeah.
Well, I'm here to publicly say Mike deserved the job.
Great.
I was a little bit of a brat.
Oh.
But I stayed for like 6 months, and then I was like, all right, like,
you're
what
ready.
Am I going to do? And then I had been there like 2 years, and I was like, I either kind of wanted to like, I either wanted to go work for Claudia Fleming or go do bread at like Sullivan Street. Like I wanted a skill that I didn't have, or I wanted to go work for like one more kind of like Jean-Georges Daniel, like a badass and kind of get my ass kicked a little. Am I allowed to say that?
Yes.
And but I also still was like a little cocky. And a sous chef position was available with Anne at the Lobster Club.
Whoa. Ooh.
So she
called
me. So
you're going back.
So I went back for more.
Woo.
Wow.
And I was the AM sous chef. Charlene Badman, who now has a restaurant in Arizona, a very good restaurant.
Know her, yes.
I lied. She wasn't the chef originally. Patty Gentry, who is now my most used farmer in Long Island, was the chef. She had worked at Arcadia with me. She was amazing, and then went to open
Lobster Club,
and then Charlene, I think, became the chef while I was there, when I started. I can't remember, but anyway, she was the chef. I was the AM sous chef, and that place. Do you remember the Lobster Club?
No, I never ate there.
Lobster Club was on like 80 something in Madison. It was in a townhouse. Anne loved the townhouse. She had like a real eye for real estate, like in spaces. And she had this 2-floor place. The kitchen was on the second floor, and prep room was in the basement. And she would do, it was like 70 something seats, that restaurant. And we would do 400 plus covers. I mean, it was nuts.
How?
It was
just how?
It was
what
nuts.
Year was this?
That was 19, probably 97, 98. And it was the hottest restaurant in town.
It was the hottest restaurant.
It was like, it was casual. She was serving meatloaf and Lobster Club sandwiches, and like
nobody had really done it
at that point. Every, yeah. To Vegas.
Everyone who was like a celebrity.
Everyone.
Diane Sawyer ate there all the time.
Yeah.
The Lauder family. And the reason I knew everyone who ate there was not because I was the chef. While I was at Arcadia, my last year there when the Lobster Club opened, I was like an eager young kid, and I wanted to know everything about the restaurant business. So,
did you work in the front of the house?
I sure did.
Oh, really?
I did not know this. I was the host.
Oh, no. Wow.
Yes,
stop.
I was. And so I would.
That was like a real fitting job.
Jesse is standing up, screaming in the control room.
So really?
Yes.
You can't believe it.
He had no idea. Look at his face.
I go to Anne, and I was like, I want to learn more. And it wasn't like a money thing. Like, it was great to make a little extra
what
cash.
What did you wear?
Oh, I rocked it. What are you talking about?
That's why I want to know what your outfits were.
What are you talking about? So I
she
would
was like,
go.
The Lauder family came in. Let's
yeah,
leave it at
I
that.
Would go.
The 90s.
So I would go to Arcadia in the morning. I mean, work a sweaty, sweaty shift. I would like, I don't think I went home. I think I would like bring my little cute suit. And I would head uptown, and then I would work. One night a week, I was in the basement answering phones.
What?
Wow. One night a week, I was on the floor.
Was it a handwritten reservation
handwritten.
Book?
Handwritten.
Love
and
those
I'm
things.
Talking like
VIP,
people who don't want to wait. People who don't, their table's 5 minutes late. They're not feeling it. I'm going to say something. I think I was pretty good.
I'm sure
I bet you
were
great. I feel like line cook is like a direct correlation. Bartender, line cook, host. You
multitask.
You're putting people where they were supposed to be.
Do you want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
About the phones?
100%. Oh.
All right. So
I want
real
to hear you
phones.
Cursing
this
at a
is
celebrity.
A great one.
Real phones with
this
wires.
This is a great one.
Attached.
So there's wires. There's four lines. They're all ringing at all four times. Oh, this is a Lobster Club. Can you please hold? One night, I'm down there. And this gentleman calls and he says, I would like to know if you use female or male lobsters for your Lobster Club sandwiches.
This is definitely the 90s. You could ask those
for
questions.
For your Lobster Club sandwiches. And I was like, I was a young cook. I didn't know. I was like, so I stupidly
oh no,
intercom Anne in the middle of service.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, hi, Anne. There's a guy on the phone. He wants to know if we use male or female. and she was like, she handled like it okay.
Steam coming out of her ears.
And I got back on the phone and I was like, you know, we really can't like pick one out for you. But, you know, the lobsters are great, whatever. The guy says, thank you. Thank you very much. I get off the phone and I'm like, I think that was Don. Don was a gentleman I was dating.
Are you kidding me?
Wow. No, he was.
He was fucking with you?
He was crank calling me.
That's phenomenal.
He was crank calling me.
I have goosebumps because he got you to call Anne in the kitchen.
And I have three other lines ringing, and I'm dealing with this guy and terrified to call Anne upstairs. And they're like, have 52 tickets on the board. And I'm like, what's a female lobster?
Out of curiosity, I'm so sorry, but like, is there a quality difference between a female and a male lobster? Like, I know there, you can tell, you flip them upside down, there's spikes.
25 years later, I still don't know.
I don't know.
But isn't it the eggs?
No, you can open, when you flip them over, they've got spikes on the bottom of the tail, so you can tell if it's a female. But I don't think
there's a quality difference. There's no difference. No. And I don't think that Sir Don
really cared.
Knew either. Yeah. Don, if you're listening.
I thought it was going to be like Sean Connery or something.
Honestly, Don, that was brilliant.
We're not going to use his last name, but Don.
That was brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Well done, Don.
Yeah. That's like one of my favorite stories.
Well done, Don. Okay, we have to fast forward to you working at the Soho Grand Hotel.
Yeah.
Okay, so you worked in a actual restaurant at the Soho Grand Hotel. There was an actual restaurant with tables and chairs and silverware and plates.
The whole time.
Where else did you work at the
Soho
Grand?
No, because then it turned into like a little
club.
Like a nightclub.
Yeah, and we had to do the things with the tiers, with the little mini short rib bites.
Yeah,
and
yeah, because guess what? That's what we were doing at the Tribeca Grand Hotel when I worked there.
I know. I think it might have been my idea. I'm not sure, but
I'm really upset
about that idea. Thank you, John DeLucy.
So Missy and I essentially... Missy and I essentially worked together. Missy was at the Soho Grand first, and then John kind of plucked me away from a small restaurant downtown.
John and I, we came...
We were there together.
We came together to poach her.
John and Missy poached me from a restaurant called Lavagna.
Which was very good, by the way.
25th anniversary last
week. It's still open.
Yep.
Is it good?
It's delicious.
I want to go.
It's so cute.
And Did you know each other before?
No. That was
the
first.
I think we got like a resume from you or something. I don't know. So I don't know how John found her, but he's like, we got to go eat the Lavagna.
You know how he found me? Sal Rizzo.
Ah, okay.
That's how he found me.
Sal Rizzo.
Shout out
Legend.
To Sal, the connector. Legend. Yes. So Missy and I worked under John. John was the executive chef and we were his chef de cuisines, I guess.
Yeah.
If you could call it that for these hotels. Missy had been working there for a while prior to me joining, and I joined the team at Tribeca Grand. Now, what you were doing, I was always so envious because you were making actual food when then I was forced to make these appetizers on these towers that would fit on a table so people could
drink. But we were doing that too. Yeah, I think you blocked it out, but I was making little tiers.
Yeah, you had cucumber sandwiches or?
I didn't do cucumber, but I mean, one of my best dishes there, I did this awesome braised short rib with mustard and onions, and there was like this.
Was there mustard oil involved?
No mustard oil, just a little.
Curious.
See?
Just
a little. She knows what mustard oil is.
By the way, I just bought some.
External use only. Read the bottle.
No. There's a company making it that is not external.
That's edible.
I'm going to take a picture and send it to you guys
later.
Wait,
but do you know how much mustard oil we drank in the 90s?
Yes, a lot.
We were not supposed to.
Yeah, I know. That's why we're all like this right now.
No, we didn't drink it, but we used it.
I want to say, like, the Soho Grand, first of all, Amanda... There were a lot of tears.
Yes,
Amanda did not last that long, but she's gone on to quite an established career. I think that was like, you know, we all get one blip in our resume.
Yes.
I think that was your previous job before Lavagna, you were there for 6 years.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That was just, I thought I wanted to learn about paperwork and administration and hotels and... God, I was learning
John,
all the things I didn't want to learn.
John always tells me that he taught me how to type. That's what
I knew how to type. Maybe that's why I got the job.
I did, but I will say, I want to say, so the Soho Grand was challenging coming out of fine dining, and it was right after I worked in Italy, and I was sort of like very open-minded, and John is very persuasive, and I wanted to see something different, and I wanted to see like, oh, I'd never worked in like a hip downtown place. At the time, the Soho Grand was like one of the hottest places. It was hot, like fire.
You've worked in so many hot spots.
I'm
heat-seeking missile.
I'm on trend. I mean, look at me.
You are so trendy.
The question is actually,
you're so Danish.
Was it hot or did you bring the heat?
I think it was hot before me. I think I added some flavor.
You brought a little heat.
She brings the heat.
But I will say, like, I went for the same reasons. I wanted to see something new. I wanted to work in a bigger place. I wanted to, like, see if I was missing out on something. I learned that I wasn't.
Yes.
But I stayed for a really long time because I kept getting promoted, and they kept giving me these, like, titles.
Big raises.
Like, big raises. And I was like, okay, I'll stay.
Yeah.
But, like, the whole time, it was still, for those younger listeners who've never looked at an ad in a newspaper, we still looked at ads in newspapers. So every weekend, I'd be like, where can I find a job?
Yeah.
And I will say the Soho Grand gave me some things. I did learn kind of administration stuff.
Yes.
I learned how I got pulled
in. You were coding your invoices?
Yeah, I coded invoices. I made schedules.
A lot of emails.
I got pulled into HR no less than once a week.
Because you were just
I was a little, like I said, I added a little color.
You were acting outside the lines.
Missy was in HR once a week.
No, it wasn't once. I'm exaggerating. Even
if you stop by just to say hello. What was our HR representative?
Neil. Shout out to Neil.
You know his name.
We know his name.
We tell stories about him often.
He's been to Lilia.
He's a legend.
Neil was amazing.
So you tortured this poor guy, but he didn't.
He would just be like, Missy.
We had never encountered anybody like this in restaurants.
Do you think that...
He would make hand gestures,
he'd be
too,
like, so,
with his fingers.
So they had something at the... They had something at the Soho Grand called the Bravo card. Mm-hmm. And if someone...
gold star.
So, yeah, so if someone did something...
Yeah.
Like above and beyond.
I never got one.
You wrote a Bravo card and you said, like, Tommy, great job making those eggs this morning. And so one day, Neil pulls me in the office and he said, Missy, Joey, I'm making up the name. Joey has been on time for work every day this week. I really think it would go a long way if you wrote him a Bravo card. And I'm like, Neil, isn't that like just a basic? Like you're supposed to be on time. And he looked at me and he goes, just write him the cards. And all the Bravo cards we have on a board. And yes. So, but I will say, all right. So John DeLucy, Amanda, two very close friends, two of my best friends. I mean, my friend Julia, she was Julia. A cook there. Julia, I mean, I talked to Julia almost every day. She lives in Nashville now. She has two great restaurants. Almost every day, if not three times a day. And my friend Emily. So, like, socially, I think there was a bond there.
Yes.
And when you work in a hotel, Dan, I don't know if you know this,
when
you work in a hotel, the kitchen is 24 hours. So at some point, you just have to be like, my shift is over.
Yes.
So if you're in management. So we would choose to have our shifts over at like 9:30, 10:00 because like people were ordering, you know, burgers by then. And it's like, all right, like, what am I going
to
do?
You don't need to be here anymore.
So Pepolino was right in between a awesome restaurant called Pepolino with the best ricotta cheesecake in New York City that I've tried to copy for 20 years now. I've almost succeeded.
Soho, Tribeca.
Yeah, so it was like
Chinatown,
right. It was like right in between the Soho Grand and the Tribeca Grand.
Mm-hmm.
So John would call and be like, "I'm leaving Tribeca. Meet me at Pepolino," and we'd like go have these late night dinners.
and
we'd all go like out for drinks. Like it was just like a good time.
Were you drinking Fernet or what was going on?
What was the name of the bar? Around the corner from the Soho Grand. I think I drank a lot
the
of margaritas.
Other room?
No. Oh, yes. But, oh, that was near Tribeca. But there was another bar. I drank a lot of margaritas. And there was
Lucky
like.
Lucky Strike, Walkers.
No.
Amanda knows every block, every bar.
Anyway, it was like a positive thing from that. 20 years later, like, we're all still friends.
Yes.
So, like, that's a beautiful thing. It was not fulfilling my cooking soul.
No.
So I applied to a job from the New York Times to a little place called the French Laundry.
Never heard of it.
Oh, wow.
Sous chef job. Thomas Keller himself
was
back in the day.
No.
Yes.
Wow.
Called me himself and said, okay, why don't you come out for a stage? We need you for 2 days. We don't pay for anything, but get yourself out here and come spend 2 days in the kitchen. And I'm like, okay. So I get a flight, I get a hotel, I get a car. I mean, the whole weekend probably cost me like $3,000 that I didn't have.
Had you been out there, been to Napa before? And like,
no, I mean, I might have been to Napa, but not there. And I go out there and I show up, and Thomas was awesome. It was like
that was a magical.
It was
time.
Like the most magical is a nice way to say it, Amanda. it was like two of the hardest days I've had in kitchens ever. Yes, I was not mentally prepared.
Because they put you through the ringer? What was it?
He didn't put me through the ringer. I think though I had worked in fine dining, that's like fine dining on steroids.
Yes, very different.
And I was a little nervous, and I was 32, and I was sort of at a weird age to be like applying to the French Laundry, and I had just gotten this CDC position. So I was like, do I keep the CDC position at like the not fine dining best restaurant in America, or do I like really go for the sous chef job? And I didn't get offered the job. I think I bombed it a little. I wasn't comfortable. Like I wasn't comfortable in the environment. So and that's not on them. That's right. Just like on like what I was used to and what I wanted. And like I said, Thomas like could not have been nicer while I was there. And I will say, like, I learned technique there that I carried on for years.
In 2 days.
Just 2 days, yeah.
Yeah, like tamming purees 42 times and the little, the towel on the sizzle platter to rest meat and to get any oil off. But, like, I use those techniques.
By the way, steep learning curve. You probably got more, like, for pound, dollar for dollar, more out of those $3,000 investments.
It's true. Yeah. That's true. Like, I really think about those couple days a lot.
But also think about how your trajectory would have changed if you stayed there. What would it be like?
I mean, she'd be plating at Lilia with a pair of tweezers, that's for sure.
We're doing that now. We are doing that a little bit. Yeah. Someone actually came into my kitchen the other day, and they're like, you have tweezers in your kitchen? So I'm like, you can't stop people. I mean, so, like, but it's a good, like, learning lesson and why it's important to stage, because you can have, like, a fantasy about going to a place and this is what I aspire to and I want to work in the best kitchen in America. But if it doesn't fit your personality, it's not the place for you to
be.
Or
the time for you to be there.
Right. It was. I think if I was 22,
oh my God,
I would absolutely have been like, yes. But I was 32. I had the CDC job and I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to stick with it. And I stuck with it for a little bit. And then out of nowhere, the Spiaggia job came up. Wow. From a headhunter.
Oh, it was a headhunter.
Alfred.
Oh, really?
Was it Alfred Ehrlich?
Alfred
the kitchen
Ehrlich.
Maestro.
So when I had come home from Italy.
Do you know the kitchen maestro?
You know
maestro?
Everybody. You're amazing.
She knows
I'm 1,000 years
Guys,
old,
we're 1,000 years old.
That's
how
incredible.
Old are you?
I'm 43 years
old. Oh,
I'm
you're
buck.
10 years younger.
Yeah, I'm a child.
Very successful at
you
a very
so?
Young age.
Mazel tov.
I mean, you had 52 meatball shops by
yeah,
the time
I've
you
had a
were
lot of
22. I don't know. So, like... Yeah, so Alfred Ehrlich had my resume had landed with him when I came home from Italy, and I was so when I came home from Italy, I had staged in Italy for like 5 months, and I was so open minded. Like that was the first I learned a new language. I was so I can do anything.
Yes,
and I said like I'll go to Chicago, San Francisco, Vegas.
I'll do anything.
But I landed at the Soho Grand, and he called me and he said, "Hey, 4 years ago, you said you would move to Chicago. Is that still true?" And I was like so ready to leave. And I was like craving fine dining. Like that's how the French Laundry thing happened. Because I just wanted to be back in like real fine dining, not even like casual fine dining. And he said, "Have you heard of Spiaggia?" And I was like, "Oh my God, my parents just ate there like a few weeks ago. It sounds great, whatever." And I didn't know who Tony was and whatever. And he said, "They have a CDC job and I think you should apply for it," whatever. So I applied. I had a call with Tony on my studio that I lived in across the street from March. And I remember exactly where I was sitting.
Again, on a phone with a wire landline.
Yeah. Tony. Well, this is a funny now that you mention it. So I didn't really know who Tony was at the time. And Tony left me a message and he has a difficult last name, Montuano. And Tony.
But at the time you would have pronounced it.
I had to listen to it on my answering machine. For those of you who know that what that is, I listened to it.
You could rewind
four times, and I'm like,
"Who is this,
Tony?
Guy?
What?" And
Monta what?
Yeah, Monta what? And so whatever, we had this amazing call for. We spoke for over an hour, and I had eaten at the restaurant that he staged in for a year with his wife, Kathy, before they opened Spiaggia.
Oh, wow.
What restaurant was that?
Del Pescatore, a three-star Michelin, woman chef.
Where is that?
It's in Mantova, not Montuano, Mantova, in like the north, in Lombardia. And I had eaten there with my family, unbeknownst to me that I would end up working at Spiaggia, and I'd eaten at all these three-star, my parents came over my last 2 weeks in Italy, and they...
Oh, you did a tour of the north and got to eat at some fantastic
Well, I told my parents, I was, again, still a little bratty then. We're at 28, 29, and my parents are like, we're going to come visit you, and I was like, I'm working. I was like, I'm very busy, and when they came, I was working at a one-star Michelin in Friuli, like all the way up north, and I was like, I'm working. I'm not going away with you. And then my dad tells me the itinerary. And I was like,
I quit.
I was like, you know what? I actually work for free. I can do whatever I want. Yeah. So I went that. It was a really special week. So it was me and my mom and my dad.
That's awesome.
And the three of us, we went to at least a Michelin star restaurant a day and had this like spectacular trip.
They made the right itinerary.
It was really cool.
Yes,
and
they
so,
did.
So when I was talking to Tony, I could kind of speak his language.
Right.
But also... Let's go back to the Soho Grand. Spiaggia is part of a giant company, Levy Restaurants, and you have to know how to do the admin stuff.
There you go.
So I now had the Italian experience, I had the March Arcadia experience, and I had this hotel experience, and that's why I got the job. I had this like combo. So Tony got off the phone. And he said, "Am I allowed to say the F word?"
Yeah,
hell yeah.
He got off the phone and he turned to his wife Kathy and he said, "God, I hope she can fucking cook. I think she's the one." He flew me out to Spiaggia, like the next week. I did a tasting, and I moved there 5 weeks later.
She can cook.
Yeah.
She can definitely cook.
Yeah.
You're not going to. I'm sorry. It's never going to happen. We're not going to talk about Lilia.
What's Lilia?
We're going
to
do
much
three
more
episodes.
Fun to talk about the 90s.
This is
right?
why this is why I was so excited for you to come in because I was like, I want to talk
everyone
about the past.
Everyone knows about Lilia.
Yeah, that's
everyone
what
knows.
Nobody knows that Missy and I have known each other for 20 years, connected by John. I cried in an office of
every
a hotel.
Day. Every day.
Listen, the weirdest part about that job being in that hotel was I couldn't talk to my sous chef. The deal was that I had to email him.
What?
It was so
I didn't have that.
Because it was
I did
on
not
the record?
In the kitchen. I was in the chef's office. The sous chef was on the line behind me and I couldn't talk to him. I had to email him. I couldn't get used to
what
it.
What an
odd. You worked in a different place than I did.
I couldn't get used to it. But anyway, I love that all fed into so many things. And I love the fact that, and I'll say this to young chef listeners, sometimes you take a job with the idea like, I'm going there for this. I'm going there because I want to learn speed. I want to learn this cuisine. You find out that you're not going to learn what you thought you were going to learn, but something better, worse, different, or you're going to make lifetime connections.
Totally.
Lifetime connections.
Totally. And I always say, like, on that note about what you think you're going to learn and what you want, like, everyone always asks me, well, what was your most important job? And I always say every single one of them.
Yes.
Every single one of my jobs, from the time I started in D.C. cooking in college to... I mean, even now, I learn every day.
What was your first job cooking in college?
1789, above the Tombs.
That was when you started?
That was my bar. My bar was the Tombs. And above the Tombs was, not my bar, I didn't own it.
But you just drank there enough that you paid for a wing in your house.
I spent a lot of time there on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sundays. And above there was this fancy restaurant, 1789, where like all these like... diplomats and presidents. And then you would like take your parents there on Parents Weekend, which oddly, I have never eaten at 17. But I
was this while you were at Georgetown?
Or my last semester senior year. My last semester senior year, I decided.
So you kind of already knew that you were moving to.
Oh no, I wanted to give it a try. I said I would do it. I did it for a couple months and then I fell in love with it. And then I went home to my parents and I said, like, hey, like, I want to do this and I'm going to make $7 an hour. What do you think? Can you help me? And they were like so into it. And they're like, if you're happy, like, we want to help you. And I said, I want to try it for a year. And if after a year it's not like the right thing, and I fell in love with it, and here we are 30 years later.
Yeah.
And you're one of these people that doesn't regret this decision, because I get so annoyed about that. Like, I love the restaurant industry. I love cooking in restaurants. Yeah. I love the camaraderie. I love the food and the whole thing. And then people are like down on it. They say negative things. I'm like, yo, man, go get a different job, buddy. If you don't love it, like, there's no point.
Well, also, I love the lineage of your experience, right? Like, I think we all kind of have this solid core 20 years before we thought it was okay to be a chef, right?
Yeah.
And people ask me about that because they'll say, sometimes I think I stayed too long, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah, I think like, I think, like you said in your 17-page intro, that Avoce almost killed me. And it didn't, but I did leave Avoce because I didn't know what I wanted to do anymore. And I was really burnt out. I didn't know. I wasn't using that word. I didn't know that I had burnout. I just knew it didn't feel particularly right. And I just didn't know if I was so stressful and so intense and this like pressure to have Michelin stars. And I had like financial bonuses attached to like how many stars I got from the Times and if I got a Michelin star, and then that pressure flowed down to Chef de Cuisine.
So
I
got a question about that, because this is like
so much pressure.
You're you know, you leave, so Italian food isn't like given Michelin stars, isn't given New York Times, like fans, you know, whatever. And then you're at Avoce and you have the opportunity to do that, but then Lilia is, I don't want to be rude, but it's like so much of a better, it's so much better of a restaurant. It's so
Thank
much
you.
More true to what
soul.
It's supposed to be. It's got soul, and it's like a place you want to be and you want to eat there. And yet it wasn't striving for any of that. And it's like, so all the time that the New York Times was like shunning the Italian restaurants and being like, you don't deserve a Michelin or like a 4-star rating or whatever. It's actually like, you know what? You shouldn't want that, because it's not, it's like worse.
Well, what's interesting is, when we opened Lilia, so I took this time off and I was like, I don't know what I want to do. I thought I wanted to go back to school. Like, I had all these crazy ideas. And I ended up coming back around after a year of hanging out and having a really good time and travel and saying, like, okay, I want to do this, but I want to do it on my own terms.
Yes.
And so I think,
fuck yeah,
I think what, I love and that wasn't just about owning a place. It was like how I remember saying to my now partner, Sean, like, hey, like, I want to open a restaurant, but like, I can't do it the way I used to do it. And so a lot of like loving the industry, not loving the industry, like I love the industry now, because I found a way to do it that really satisfies me. Mm. And even, look, it's taken me, Lilia just turned 8.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Mm. Missy's 6. And
wow.
We just opened Missy Pasta.
Missy Pasta. Missy Pasta.
And when I think about, like, you know, Lilia and what I wanted, like, look, I was on the line for the first 2 years of Lilia.
Yes.
I didn't have another job, so I expedited and I was there on, you know, I took days off, but like I was there, and same kind of for Missy for the first 8-9 months. And now I have, like, you know, I'm 52, maybe about to turn 53, and I have like changed the parameters again. So
you have to keep changing.
I don't really work at night anymore. I live in the neighborhood of all three of our places. I can hit them every day if I want.
Yes.
I can not hit them. I can be there in an emergency. And I don't really often work on weekends.
Mm-hmm. But
and I have kind of like the life that I want. And that takes a really long time. Like, that being said, that's not available to a young cook. Like, it's a very hard thing, but, like, if you do the thing and if you stick with it and if you really can figure out what you want, you can have the life you want. I think it took me a long time, but I also really – I had to be really encouraged. Like, Sean every night would be like – we lived in the same building, which is how we met. And we, at the time Lily opened, we lived in the
West
Village.
Sean, your partner.
Yeah, Sean, my business partner. And like, he would come to me at like 9:30, 10 and be like, let's go. We're like, let's take a car home. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm not leaving. Like,
but you
and
need
like,
that.
And he's like, what do you mean you're not leaving? And I was like, I'm going to stay till the last ticket. And I had the last ticket mentality that I'm sure you guys had too. And it took me till like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to be like, okay, I can like leave earlier. I cannot work at night. I can like everything's gonna be okay. We have amazing teams.
Isn't it almost like a parental thing? It's like if you take care of yourself as a parent of these restaurants, the restaurants themselves will grow and be better.
Yeah.
No, I think that – I'm sorry.
But no, but I'm asking the question. Yeah, asking the question, but also we have to ask the Obamas question. But
not interesting.
But, not interesting what they were like, well done
it
steak?
Was so, it was just like so long ago when I like
– And I'm sorry. What about the Manhattan? Will you ever open in Manhattan? Everybody wants to know.
We got a lot of questions.
Who's everyone?
We're fighting here.
All of Manhattan.
We got to do 2 hours, guys.
All of your fans.
Your fans. Amanda.
Are we going to get another exclusive here on the Line podcast?
You're not going to get an exclusive, but I'll say this. I was not – a Brooklyn person.
I know.
The first time I went to look at Lilia, I called. Sean's texting me.
I never thought you would leave Manhattan.
He was in finance then, and he's at his desk, and he asked me to go look at the space. He said, please go there. And I was like, yeah, I'm not opening in Williamsburg. And he goes, just go look at the space. And I said, all right. So he's texting me like voraciously, and he's like, how is it? And I was like, it's cool. Like, it was truly.
Mike and I looked at that location.
Really?
We were going to do a Buffalo style sandwiches and chicken wing bar called, we have a business plan for it. It was called The Junkyard. And it had, and there were going to be cars that you could dine in, like broken cars that you could
dine in.
And you could eat
You're
chicken
making
wings.
This but up,
I'm not,
right?
I've got a not... business plan for it. It was called The Junkyard.
Please send that to me.
I was, the Junkyard. Junkyard Bones.
Okay, well, instead we got Lilia.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I said to Sean, I was like, I think it has like a lot of potential. It has amazing bones. I mean, it was a disaster when I saw it. I said, but I don't really know how to get home from here. And
cabs go there.
I had like someone had driven me there. I hardly like had spent any time in Brooklyn. And that's like, it's hard to admit. And then like, I remember Seamus Mullen said to me one night when we decided to open Lilia and I was still living in the West Village. And he said, I'll bet you you're gonna be living in Williamsburg. And I was like, yeah, no way. I'm never leaving the West Village. 8 months in, I'm like sitting in traffic on the Williamsburg Bridge, going home at midnight, and I'm tired because I'm like working crazy days and I'm still like in front of a fire all day. And I'm like, I think I got to do it. Sean moved a month before me. We lived in the same building. Sean moved and then I moved. But even when I moved, I was so like defensive about it. And I was like, I just need to change. I have a lot of life change.
You would justify it.
And I was like, I'm going to be back in Manhattan in a year. And then like,
you moved to the suburbs.
Anybody who knows you thinks of you as this, you know, Brooklyn, you know, icon now. I mean, you're
so weird.
But
it is. And so my
point.
She's
got skinny jeans on.
They're not skinny. They're not that skinny. But
skinny jeans are out, by the way.
Yeah, they're not in.
I might not be 42
years old. Mom jeans are in.
I think I said that. That's not true.
You might be 90.
I'm older than that.
He doesn't even know how old he is.
but what my point is about Manhattan is like, I don't have anything against Manhattan. What has happened is we have built this community in Williamsburg. We both live in Williamsburg, and I think there's something very special about that going on. That being said, because of what I said, like, I'm not ever opening Williamsburg, I will never say never to anything.
Right.
I think, like, the right thing would have to happen in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And, like,
I love the idea of community, though, and I think that's missing right now in New York City restaurants.
I never thought it was important. But I never, because I worked in destination restaurants and very fine dining, and they were all like in these fancy neighborhoods. It's not that I didn't think it was important. It's not something I ever even thought about. Mm. And it's not even till like, I mean, you know, we've been there 8 years now, and like now, you know, we have Lilia, Missy Pasta, Sean has Fini Pizza. And they're all like really close, and it's really nice. And you walk down the street and people like say, "Hey, what's up? I ate at your place last night." Yeah. And it's really, really nice. And it's very different than going to work at the Time Warner Center, going up an escalator, not knowing a soul. So there's something about that
beautiful.
I love.
Yeah.
But I would never say like, no, I'm never going to open anything in Manhattan.
Right.
Like, that's not what it's about. It's just about how our lives have developed, both personally and professionally. And like,
There's a maturity.
Sean's raising his family there, and he loves it. And you know, he thought he'd be living in New Jersey by now in a house and commuting in. So, like, our lives both changed a lot, and for the better, I think. And
absolutely. I love that though, because I think if we can get back to community in restaurant, it will help a lot. It will help everybody, not just your individual businesses, the businesses around you. Like, even in the neighborhood where Lilia is, that's changed so much since you guys opened.
Yeah.
That's the Lilia effect.
Well, it's a lot of things effect, but
who's
like
the guy that opened that restaurant in Green Palm around the corner from there, and it failed.
You changed
so
the neighborhood.
The reality is that so many people tried to open restaurants that were of your caliber in that area and failed. That neighborhood was not ready for you, and you made it ready for you. That's
I remember.
You
thank
them
you.
There.
That's
it's,
very
that is
kind.
Just the truth.
I remember someone saying to me, like, "You got to do X because you're in Brooklyn. You got to do Y because you're in Brooklyn." And I remember looking at them and being like, "You know what? Brooklyn is just a location. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do me."
Yes.
I'm still an advocate of the shot and a beer special at Lilia, but it hasn't ever happened. I've been pushing for it.
Well, next time you come in, buddy,
you can have whatever you want.
You wait. It's gonna happen.
Can I say? I'm so sorry to say this as well. Like,
say it.
You made a linguine and clam sauce for me. And it was like, it wasn't on the menu. It was a thing you made.
I did?
Yes, you did. You just brought it over. I was sitting at the bar, and it was in like a cup. You put it in a cup.
What?
At Lilia.
And you were testing something out.
You literally put it in for it. And I have been thinking about that pasta and making it for myself at home, and I've never quite gotten there since.
I've literally been trying to recreate
that dish.
Stop it.
There's so many dishes that I remember, like pork and fennel, so many things ate that were amazing. But that clam sauce, it made me angry and jealous. Like, there was something you did, and I was like, how come?
It's in my
book. Yeah, but it was so damn good when you made it. I've never been able to do it. Like,
okay,
that.
Well, let's do it together. Let's figure it out. Fly me out to LA.
A shot, a beer, and clam sauce.
Shot, beer, a little pizza at your place, and some clam sauce. Like,
so good.
Well, I am the bad guy, and I have to wrap it up. But I want to say the future is Missy. Missy everything. Missy pasta. Missy Robbins. Missy everything. Everybody.
Thank you guys. This was like seriously really fun.
That was fun for
I've
you.
Been looking forward to
you
this
guys,
all week.
By the way, you guys should keep doing this. You're good at it.
Oh, thank you. You're not so bad at it yourself.
Pretty good.
Oh, the control room's going wild. Yay.
Yeah.
All right.
I love it.
That made me so happy.
On the Line was recorded in New York City at Dubway Studios. Thanks, Al. Our studio engineer and editor is Mark Frangiolo.
Our theme song is an original composition generously donated and played by Chef John DeLucci.
Our producer is Cindy Augustine, and our co-producer and publicist is Jesse Gerstein.
That's all, folks. Thanks for listening.